So we'll have to wait and see if that has any relevance to the talk at all. But, you know, don't scratch the itch meditation. Maybe that can be a standalone feature. And maybe it'll appear to be very relevant. That will really depend on what the talk turns out to be. You know, there can be this perception that we have that, you know, I'm sitting here with this thing on my lap that's got my talk contained in it. And then for some reason, instead of just, you know, doing it any other way, I'm going to read from here and, you know, deliver to you a talk. And that more or less this talk is going to be the talk that I imagine it's going to be. But my experience has shown that actually quite a lot of the talk actually comes from you. Or at least it doesn't come from me, so I'm going to blame you for it. And so we're kind of participating in creating this talk. And what that kind of implies is that if we're all doing the talking, then our usual concept of what a talk is doesn't really kind of hold up. If the audience is actually a participant in the creation of a talk, then, you know, that idea of me just sitting here and listening to the talk, doesn't exactly make sense. And maybe that's a little bit like not scratching an itch. It doesn't really make sense, but it's something worth doing once in a while. So one way of putting this talk into a sentence is that I imagine that everything is imagined. And that is to say that things are not what they appear to be. Things are actually not even themselves. Okay, so now we've started with the difficult stuff. We'll work backwards and start at the beginning. So we're doing metta practice. And we may or may not have a sense of what on earth that means. And we may be less clear now about what metta is than we were when we read the title and decided to sign up. And we may feel that we're really getting clear about what metta is. And that'll come in waves through the day. It's like, oh, I'm getting it. I really haven't got a clue. No, I'm getting it again. I've got a sense. And that's difficult for us because metta keeps changing. We keep changing. Yeah? And so let's say what we know of as friendliness. Okay, so dropping the Pali, just sounds like friendliness. Friendliness is offered to friends, right? That's what friendliness is offered to. Friendliness is offered to, like, nice experiences. But what we're exploring with metta is actually opening it out to not friends and to not nice experiences, whatever that means, whether they're more kind of neutral experiences or even quite difficult experiences. Okay, let me know if the volume or the speed needs any kind of adjustments. Yeah. Higher? Louder means? Okay, yeah, we'll go for it. And slower? Okay. So, yeah, just wave like you're drowning or something when I change either of those two features. So, we naturally feel metta towards people or phenomena which we like. But the real interesting thing comes when we start extending it and expanding it into other areas of our life. And, you know, there's a nice phrase from Jesus. And if we put this, just like squeeze it right down, he actually says, even the tax man loves his brother. And I guess he didn't think, even the tax man loves his brother, even the one who collects your taxes. And that was quite a, you know, difficult feeling towards the tax man in, you know, these Roman times. As there possibly is now, yeah. But even the tax man loves his brother. And I hope afterwards, you know, Jesus, you know, put it right and did a nice metta meditation where all his disciples and followers did a, you know, loving kindness meditation towards the tax man and all the money that the tax man's taken and, you know, all the things that they were supporting. But what this is kind of suggesting, so again, what is this suggesting is, you know, it's easy to do the easy, but that's not exactly what we're here for. Like, we're here to push the edges to stretch into what could really be possible. And metta can do so much more. It can do so much more when it's allowed into other areas. Yeah. And this is more or less what we're experiencing on the retreat. Yeah. It generates different experiences. And there's even this kind of movement towards infinity that we can drop into when, and it may or may not have kind of worked for you if you were in the guided meditation in the afternoon. What happens when we guide metta towards metta? Yeah. What happens when we start to kind of feed in like a feedback loop of metta into metta, metta into metta? So we're adding this welcoming to this welcoming quality that we're feeling inside of ourselves. And this kind of loop of well-wishing towards well-being kind of supports something quite different. And if we imagine that dukkha is this sense of ill-being, yeah, ill at ease, then we can see that this is resolving that situation, easing dukkha, and also not creating the conditions for further dukkha to arise, further difficulty and stress to arise. So another thing that's quite interesting about metta, as we guide it into uncommon areas for our experience, is that we notice that it changes according to the phenomena that it meets. So this is a way of saying metta is empty. It depends on the phenomena that it meets. And the way I see this is that, you know, when friendliness meets pain and suffering, it transforms into compassion. Yeah, that's how we feel it. Like, it wants to support, it wants to bring to an end this feeling of difficulty. And when it tunes in to the pleasant things in life, or even when it tunes into itself, it starts to turn into something quite joyful, quite beautiful, quite blissful kind of experience. And when we bring metta towards something that we can't change, yeah, that brings us towards this sense of needing to accept, it spreads out into equanimity, it spreads out into peace with this thing as it's unfolding. And so what we can see is, if you've heard these teachings before, you'll recognize that there are four Brahma Viharas, four divine abodes, four immeasurable qualities of the heart, which is metta, this quality of friendliness, is karuna, this quality of compassion and care, and mudita, this quality of appreciation and joy, and taking joy in what's beautiful, and upekkha, which is the equanimity, the deep, stable state of peace, in which all of these practices lead towards and unfold within. And in the teachings, each of these are given, you know, a specific place and a specific importance, and are qualities to really practice for. And in a certain way, we could say they're all metta. They're all kind of forms of metta in the way I described it. It's just one way of looking at it. And it's also really worthwhile to understand that, like metta, they have their mundane, kind of familiar things. Yes, we can feel it towards friendliness, towards the friendly. We feel compassion towards those we feel empathy with. But we can also notice that all of them have the potential for going towards the infinite, going beyond their limits. So we can say, you know, what does compassion look like? And it really depends. It depends on what it's meeting. And it depends on what's moving us in that way. Like, compassion might be soft and loving, or it might be strong and assertive. Yeah, and we can't say, oh, that's not compassion. it's all strong and assertive. You know, compassion is soft and loving. It really depends on that circumstance. It really depends on what's there. And this feeling of mudita, this feeling of maybe bliss, beauty, joy, it can be also trapped and limited. We could say, it's limited inside a sense of worth. Yes, when we see another person being happy, and what kind of comes up for us? Like sometimes we can feel like, oh, what did they do to deserve that? And what didn't I do that I don't deserve to be happy? Or do I deserve to be happy when I'm practicing these metta phrases? Maybe this comes up for us, maybe not. Much of it depends on our cultural sense also. And there can also, like our culture, you know, and many of those factors. And also it can feel that there's not enough happiness to go around, not enough bliss to go around. If someone else is happy, maybe they've gotten my happy, you know, and I want it back. Well, they should at least share some of it, you know. But we can actually see another person being happy is actually an opportunity to be happy for them, to be happy with them. They can kind of tune us in, yeah, if we can get into that. In a way, it's a real gain for us. Like, we don't need to wish that they'd be happy. They already are happy. We can kind of have a break from the metta practice and just, oh, they're happy already. And all of this points to kind of an emptiness, a dependent origination. And it really points to the importance of appropriateness and of playfulness. So we can really explore all the different ways that we do our practice through these different lenses. And compassion, in particular, is really dependent on who we feel empathy towards. And I would say that's also dependent on some sense of equality with others. You know, the sense of them having worth. And as I say, it can be really limited by social pressures. It can be really limited by cultural shared understandings. Or by, you know, kind of a personal fear. They all shape who we can feel compassion towards. But that's just kind of pointing out a boundary which is fabricated, yeah, which can be played with. We can move it around by the way we think, by what we contemplate. So something we can play with is, you know, right now, do I feel a broad kind of equality with all human beings? Yeah, and just explore all human beings on planet Earth, yeah, and all the different countries and all the different conditions. Do we feel, you know, human rights for everyone? You can notice, where are the edges? Where are the edges? Why is that edge there? In what way is that edge there? Yeah, something to play with. We could see if we can expand those same rights perhaps to all intelligent animals. Like, there are lots more intelligent animals than just humans in this kibbutz. You know, like over there, there's a load of cows in a big old cage, yeah? And how do we feel about that? You know, there's this idea of non-human persons. I don't know if anyone's heard of this idea. That there should be a classification for some large intelligent animals like lions and dolphins, that they should be treated as persons, as a person, a non-human person. Because of the degree of intelligence they show. Yeah? They shouldn't just be killed, tortured, put in cages, treated inhumanely. Yeah? Because they are actually intelligent. But in fact, the question isn't, are they intelligent? The question for us is, do they suffer? If they suffer, they're worthy of our compassion, right? Isn't compassion given to those who suffer? This is the dependency we look for. And yet we can also see it can go the other way. That there can even be, we can be fooled. We can kind of be fooled into taking some humans as being not worthy of our compassion. Yeah? And we can see that we can be tricked into this. People are made to look or feel less than human. And we know there are stories of this happening in human history. Yeah? We know of this. And we also know of it happening in human present. This is happening. And we can also notice it in our personal story. You know, has someone in our life ended up on the outskirts of our heart? Or perhaps out of our heart altogether? It's all kind of really meaningful questions in our practice to test the boundaries, to test the limits. And those limits are fabricated, they're made up. They're not real boundaries because they can change. We can change them. And that's an important part of our practice some of the time. You know, depends. You decide what your practice is. But for me, I would say practice is essential to be allowed to play with boundaries that are just made up. Yeah. So sometimes we bring metta to the difficult relationship. And I think we all have someone in some way that's something of a difficult relationship. Someone we're annoyed with, frustrated by, or who's hurt us in some way. And metta and the whole movement of meditation and of kind of clearing up our untidy lives kind of draws us back towards these difficult relationships. Yeah? They come up in our minds, whether we're purposely going to practice with them or not. And we kind of, for some of us, we need to find a way back into that relationship. And the way back into the heart can be, you know, a way of reframing the story, a retelling of the memory. And as we retell a difficult relationship with that willingness to reconnect with this person, it can be really helpful to not just see them as someone who's wounded me, someone who makes the wounded. But it can be quite helpful to also explore how they too are wounded. And this will work well with not the most difficult things in our life. You know, that if it's something really deep, something really traumatic, and that should really be explored in a very kind of safe and held way. But if it's just someone who's annoyed us, yeah, and is kind of on the outskirts of the heart in this way, it can be really helpful to see them this way. Now, I have a personal example that, you know, I'm sure you just can't imagine why, but my sister-in-law thinks I'm a jerk, thinks I'm an idiot, you know, thinks I'm a really nasty kind of person some of the time. And, okay, like, I tried to change her mind, but I haven't managed yet. So it comes up sometimes for me, the metta towards the difficult person. And what someone wise kind of guided me towards is actually changing it into compassion, to see her struggles, to see her difficulties, to see what's hard for her in her life, what's painful. And in that way, it kind of starts to open the heart towards compassion. The compassion starts to follow the story. Yeah? The way I see this person shapes that feeling of connection and that feeling of care. And suddenly they're changing. They're not the maker of wounds and the wounded. They're also wounded, just like me. Yeah? Just like how I feel. And not feeling alone in that feeling of woundedness also allows it to flow out again, keep flowing. And that feeling of connection stays open, that feeling of love and togetherness in something remains open. And from there we might use compassion phrases or compassion kind of vibration, or it may, you know, revert back to the metta, but you know, those kind of compassion phrases of may your pain be eased, may it come to an end, may it be met well, may it be peaceful. And so what we're seeing is the relationship is not fixed. It really depends on how we relate to it. How we relate to them depends on how we see them. Yeah? We have an image of people. We make up that image. We hold on to that image. And so we have some responsibility to that image and a responsibility to change that image if it's going to be more helpful. So we can gently and with compassion for all involved, including ourselves, we can not only know that there is change possible, but we can actually contribute to that change. So I want to tell a little story. It's my version of it, because I don't remember things very well. You may have heard it before, and then you may feel that I've gotten the story wrong. But maybe actually I'm getting the story right and the way you heard it before was wrong. We'll probably never know. My friend who studied English literature told me that there's actually a device that's used in stories. And I must warn you, this is very cheap psychology. Very kind of back of the napkin psychology. But if we hear a story first told within a novel or something, and later they tell another version of that story, we tend to believe the first story a little bit more than the second one, and doubt the second one more than we did the first. And so just bear that in mind in life and in your practice, and also now in this story. So it's actually quite a traumatic story, and you know, if it does disturb you in any way, I really apologize, and do seek us out if it you know does touch anything. But it involves a murder, unfortunately. But that's part of the amazing part of the story. So somehow one young man killed another young man. And so the mother of the deceased, the mother of the killed young man, is in the court watching the trial of the murderer. And they did it, and they admit that they did it, and you know, she's there witnessing the unfoldment of the trial. And the sentence is given, and the young man is taken away to prison. And as he's walked out of the courtroom, she comes to the front of the, you know, where she was, and looks him right in the eyes and says, "I'm going to kill you." And the young man is taken away and spends time in jail. And after a little while, he's surprised to receive a letter from this woman. And she wants to know more about him, more about his life. And you know, it's probably very difficult to reply to that letter, and another letter comes, also opening the avenue of communication, of connection. And they start to write to each other. And he starts to explain the difficulties of his life. And she comes to visit him and gets a real sense of what a lonely soul he's been, what an abandoned soul he's been, what a hard life he's had. And this relationship continues, this bond kind of develops in a way, this connection born of understanding, deeper understanding, compassion and care, even friendliness towards someone who actually took away her dearly loved son. And so that would be kind of an amazing story in itself. But actually, somehow in this story, it gets almost unbelievable. That eventually his behavior starts to transform, and his behavior within the prison is kind of recognized, and his good conduct is acknowledged. And he's even given kind of an early release. And she's supportive of this and helps him through that process. And when it becomes time for him to leave, she knows that he actually has nowhere to go. And she says to him, as you know, I have a spare room. And I'd be really happy if you came and lived with me for a while. And, you know, this is really remarkable. And this connection continues, and she helps him to find a job, and they're kind of living together in this house. And she turns to him and says, do you remember that day in the courtroom? When I looked at you and I said, I'm going to kill you. And he replies, I never forget it. It was the most frightening and painful experience of my life. And she says, and I did it. I killed you. I killed the murderer. And yeah, she did. So this degree of change is available in the human life by a remarkable stretch of who we include in our range of friends and compassion. Really, nothing is fixed, not even who we are. Yeah, not even who we think we are. Who then am I? If my relationships change, who I take myself to be changes, what's this sense of self? What does it mean to be me in all these changing conditions? You know, our minds change, our moods change. Things we used to think, we don't think anymore. It's all just flowing and changing, changing. You know, we can feel like this is my body sometimes. We can feel that we are in ownership of this body sometimes. Or we can feel that we exist within this body sometimes. But even this body is constantly changing. Yeah? Renewing its cells. It's made of food. So much is made of food. Are you just a whole series of plates of food? With a sense of, yeah, it's me. I mean, it's interesting how quickly we take food out of the pots and it hits our plate and then it's my food. And maybe that's the beginning of my body, my identification. But it's the same food that's in the pot. And in fact, we can even see this sense of ownership of the body isn't really that good for either of us in this relationship. You know, I made two kind of diet choices some while back. I thought that I should eat kind of a gluten-free or wheat-free diet for my digestive system. and that I should eat a vegan diet because of the cows in prison on the other side of the kibbutz. And for me, it was very easy to do the vegan diet because I don't want to cause suffering to the cows on the other side of the kibbutz. But for me, this is my body, and I'll eat wheat now and again, you know, in a very light way, because I own this body. But I don't own this body. It's not me. It's not mine. It's not myself. And when I see it that way, I care for it more. The connection to my body, without it being my body, you know, the connection to this body here, has more compassion when I don't own it, when I don't identify as it. Well, that's kind of weird. It would appear that identification would be the closest we could possibly get to something. But it's not. It's a block. And another way is when we investigate, what is this body anyway? What is this body? And one way of looking at it is to say, body is not body. Body is also not self. It's not even itself. Things are not themselves. Body is made up of non-body parts. Right? An arm is not a body. A torso is not a body. Legs are not a body. Head is not a body. Yeah? So what is a body? It's not just a collection of body parts, is it? Kind of doesn't make sense. That we're having an identification with something that doesn't exist in the way we imagine it exists. And it keeps on going. Everything is divisible into not itself. The hand is not made up of hand parts. It's made up of fingers and palm, back of hand, skin, cells. And cells are not made up of cell parts. You know, they're all divisible, divisible, divisible. And it keeps on going, keeps on dividing. Forever and ever and ever. There's no single one thing making up all of this that has its own independent, inherent existence, even on the level of form. And the same with this mind and what we think and the intellect. So the thoughts that make up the intellect are not the intellect, and they change. And they're also inconstant. It's so important to see all of this, that anything that we identify as is itself inconstant. It is not constant. And yet we have a sense of something lasting about who I am. Lasting, this kind of sense of self kind of endures through all the things that it could possibly be. And we'll explore them very shortly. And if everything is inconstant, if we haven't yet found something that lasts, yeah, or does.
I think lasts is not understood.
It's okay. Thanks. Okay. This is a. All right. So, what was I saying? So, no thought lasts, right? That's why I can't remember it. So, and they constantly change. And it makes no sense to claim ownership of things which constantly change, right? Doesn't make sense. Like the whole point of ownership would be for some kind of lasting ownership, I would imagine. You know. And it also doesn't make sense to claim ownership of a moving pattern or of, you know, a changing process of inconstant things. And something even more radical is that we can notice that even our sense of self is in constant change. Yeah. So we can feel it as it swings between the intensity of being really annoyed, yeah, or really pained, or when we're really embarrassed or ashamed. And it all kind of comes up, very, very solid and profound sense of self. And then it can fade into these moments where we're really kind of open and relaxed, or when we're kind and generous. And just noticing that there's this flow in the self-sense, in the sense of self. There's this flow. It kind of releases something, depressurizes something, lets out the steam. Lets out the steam? Depressurizes it? No? Going backwards? Thanks.
But it's in nature everywhere. And air becomes water, water becomes ready. Everything is changing to something else. It's not only human beings.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So it's a question. That, I mean, it's something beyond our understanding. It's more like how energy can become a body or become a soil or water. Or this is something beyond our understanding yet. I mean, the science didn't get how a leaf from a tree become a tree and a soil and the earth. Air become water. Uh-huh. And we can see that it happening, but we don't know how.
I'm not quite sure. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Thanks. Okay. So, you know, there can be this sense that everything changes but you. This is another horrible lyric from a song. And, you know, that can be kind of the kind of theory we get from a love song. You know, there's something very beautiful and sweet about the sentiment that you always remain the same, no matter what, which actually, if we kind of imagine it, would actually be one of the worst conditions to ever be in. But what this singer is kind of imagining is actually my image of you has remained fixed while you actually have gone on changing. And I'm still in love with the image of you. And I've written a song to the image of you. And if you would like it on behalf of that image, then it's for you.
It's also a popular greeting in birthdays.
Mm.
It's a disaster to say to someone, don't change.
Yeah, 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 and we're going to change. And actually what we can really feel is there's a part of us that doesn't want to change, yeah, and certainly that wants to be fixed. And we grab hold of these things, seeking their kind of lasting satisfaction, but they're going to change. And another way of describing dukkha, I think Zohar gave the description of the bumpy ride of dukkha. No? Yes. Is that dukkha is the rope burn that you get when you hold on to the rope that's moving and it burns, the friction burns. Dukkha is that rope burn of holding on to moving things. The sense of self depends on what it leans on. And when it leans on changing things, then it leans on these images which remain fixed in the mind, the concept of things which remain fixed in the mind. But when we really look deeply, we realize that everything is changing. And, you know, as we're saying, you know, that feeling of embarrassment, that feeling of tension and all these kind of things that bring a stronger sense of self, are a lot around this story of wanting something, wanting to get something. So when our sense of self is strong, we can feel, I must be wanting to get something or wanting to get rid of something, kind of on a mission, and sense of self gets stronger in that. But what that actually means is quite interesting is, what if I choose not to get that thing? What if I choose not to get rid of that thing? What if I choose not to scratch that itch? Who then do I become? What then happens? And there's something quite curious in meditation practice when we play around with this sense of self and sense of experience and sense of not listening to the urge, to the demand to do this, do that, is we find a peace. We find a peacefulness inside beyond our sense of who we normally would be. You follow the urge, you become who you know yourself to be.
Yeah.
You follow the urge and you become who you sense yourself to be. If you don't follow the urge, who then do you become? What then do you experience? And it keeps coming back, then who then are we? Or what then are we?
Who's experiencing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, who is doing all this experiencing? And the teachings are not saying we're a someone or we're a no one. But we're saying that it depends on other factors, this sense of who we are, right? It's not that there's no self, and it's not that there is a self. Neither of these positions lead to freedom from suffering. Yeah? They're fixed positions in a changing, dependent, interdependent, unfolding experience. And an interesting part of meditation, if I didn't already say it, I'm getting lost in my own labyrinth of a talk, a whole maze of a talk, is that certain meditation experiences bring an even lighter sense of self than we're familiar with in interactive experience of living. You know, the meditator experience, the quietening down of that sense of self can get quieter and quieter. And yet, you know, whenever there's an experience, there's some sense of self. Whenever there's an experience, there's some sense of self, even a very light sense of self. And so we see that our sense of self is dependent on the experience. And typically, we could say it feels more wholesome, it feels more beneficial to have a lighter sense of self. And in fact, it really becomes a characteristic of beautiful, pleasant experiences. Yeah, those beautiful experiences of love and openness and kindness. So much so that we could even say that a strong sense of self is the indicator of a stronger level of dukkha. A strong sense of self is a good indicator that there is contraction and dukkha. And so we have in the teachings made available for us a description of the clinging aggregates and the skandhas. They make up everything that we can form a sense of self from. And they're not like a depiction of the self. This is not a description of the self, right? It's not this. The clinging aggregates are not a description of what the self is. they are a way of exploring anywhere that a sense of self may land. So we could say, we might feel that this body, this physical form, is mine, or it's me, or it is it's mine, it's me, or it's the kind of the vehicle of me, where I reside within it, or it is contained within me. So some of these seem like, well, I would never say that, you know. But at least one of these, or some other way, we kind of have an identification with the body. And tomorrow we'll kind of open up to this kind of as a new meta practice of actually seeing that not self, nature of selves, yeah, the not body nature of body. And the not ownership of this body, which just would be impossible to do, not to mention unhelpful to do, I think for some pretty good reasons. So we can see the body and the Vedana meeting contact, yeah, in any moment. Both of those, in constant. And they lean on other factors for them to be there. This can't be who I am. This perception, what we notice, the underlying intentions that we have, you know, they all change. And they all lean on other things to come into being. And even this ever-present sense of knowing is dependent on an object in awareness. Right? If there's no object in awareness, then what do you know? You can't know a state of not knowing, and there's always an object that is being known. Yeah? You notice that about knowing? There's always this object being known. But everything we know is inconstant, which means that knowing, which is dependent on objects which are inconstant, must also be inconstant, coming into and out of being. Moments of knowing. We can't be knowing either. Knowing is dependent on objects which come into and out of being. So everything changes. Everything leans as well. Everything leans on something else. Knowing leans on objects. Yeah? Perception leans on objects. You can't bring attention to something without the intention to bring attention. So they lean on each other. And they're both inconstant. So this can't be who I am.
Can I ask?
Yes.
So how can one be free if everything's changing? Like, does freedom also change? Or is there a state in which freedom is lasting?
I mean, it's a great question. And it depends on what you mean by freedom. So if we say
that Buddha kind of freedom.
The Buddha kind of freedom so the Buddha's particular type of freedom is a freedom from conditioned things through relating to conditioned things in more wholesome ways. So as I was saying in the other talk, we can change from a lot of thinking to very little thinking by changing from very, very sticky thoughts to thoughts which are more beneficial and have less stickiness, to thoughts which are more beneficial and have less stickiness, to thoughts which are more beneficial than that and have less stickiness. And then slowly, slowly, we're released from that bond of thinking towards something where the thinking is just helpful and it's supportive of this, and then slowly that fades and that disappears. And so the whole path of the Buddha's type of freedom is less fabrication, less fabrication, less fabrication, less fabrication, until pop, into the unfabricated. And this is the Buddha's version of freedom. Your own version of freedom may be slightly different. So this may be a good time to remember that we're actually doing this all together. So if this talk starts to hurt, you know, I think it was you who did that. So we'll notice that there will be some inclination to identify, you know, some inclination to want to find a foundation in emptiness. It's like, oh yeah, but I'll just get my foot on that and my leg on that and my arm on that, and like some kind of emptiness twister game where we try and stay up, but there's nothing constant for us, nothing constant. And so it's dukkha to presume that we are these things. It's dukkha to imagine that we own these things. It's dukkha to imagine that we exist within these things. And it's dukkha to imagine that these things exist within me. And so the Buddha's teaching is that any clinging to these aggregates, you know, body, vedana, perception, all the kind of fabricating elements of where we place our intention and our intentions, and even this quality of knowing. Any clinging to these, any grasping onto these, or any fabrication of a sense of self with these is dukkha. So I've left myself a note here, which just says, the end. You can make it. It's kind of a warning that we're doing the last little sprint to the finish here, so hang in there, and I'll hang in there as well. So we'll notice that we will habituate towards a sense of ownership or sense of control of these aggregates. Maybe our sense of self normally kind of fits in somewhere like we're kind of the manager or the conductor of the aggregates, and we take them around and we lead them here and there, and we have this kind of control, and that's my sense of self, that's who I am. And even though they keep changing all the time, in some way I manage to kind of jump from one to the other and stay as a me, as I am. And that is our perception, and perception is not really reliable. It's not really reliable. And we keep coming back. Who, or maybe what, are we? And the Buddha is saying, this is not an appropriate question. It doesn't matter. Appropriate attention calls us back again and inquires, what is the wholesome and skillful thing to do with these inconstant things that we have a habit towards identifying with? All holding to a view is to some degree dukkha. You know, a sense of self is useful. And it's useful because it's inconstant. Yeah? It's useful because it's inconstant and should be seen as thus.
It's useful because?
Because it's inconstant.
Because it's changing.
Because it's changing. And that's what it's useful for. Changing.
Because the world is changing at the same time.
Yeah, everything is changing. And so don't be attached to it as well, yeah? That's what makes sense. So we pay attention, we see that all things are inconstant, and we see them as inconstant, and we don't grasp. Yeah? We don't try to fix the illusion. Yeah? Don't try and fix it. Don't make a sound theory about emptiness and also not about self. Nothing fixed. So we're looking to reduce that grasping on, reduce that clinging, that inflexibility to our view of self-sense. Yeah? Can we release that view of inflexibility to something which is changing, which is fluid, which is moving? And that's a real challenge. You know, we can feel this groundlessness, this openness without foundation. Yeah? We can feel it, and we can feel a fear towards it at times, yeah? a resistance to it. You know, we don't want to be groundless. We don't want to be open without foundation. It feels worrying. yeah? But trying it each time, when we open out the sense of self-sense into more spaciousness, into less holding, what does it actually feel like? Does it feel liberating? Does it feel easeful? And if it does, then we can move in that direction. Because when we stay with it, when we stay with something less grounded, less founded in something apparently solid and real, we can see that the discomfort was just our self-created instability of trying to fix this thing. Trying to fix a place in the unknown. Finding my place in the unknown. Yet maybe we can actually rest here without fixing. Yeah. That we can actually abide, live in side of this empty and open state of being. Yeah, right in the wide, wonderful mystery of it all.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
If there is the no self and not doing the selfing about anything,
mm-hmm.
Why all the meditation is with eyes closed and with this body?
So I think this is also a question which is kind of leaning towards one side or the other of this self, not self. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we're saying if there's not self, we're saying that things which appear to be themselves are made up of not self elements. Mm-hmm. And that's opening the grasping, opening the holding onto the experience. So we have the existence with bodily form. So we pay attention to the body, which we can experience. And through our way of relating and experiencing the body, we can release tensions. And so we're playing with a fabricated experience of the body. But that's a really kind of like another whole thing to go into. And I think, you know, some people are exhausted and maybe like they need to rewire their brains. So I don't want to give another more kind of complex example of something. I mean, I wouldn't say I was trying to be very simple in this talk, but I don't want to be more complex than I was. So we work with what we find in our experience. And we develop that, and we develop ways of looking at that which change the way it appears to us. So it appears to us that this is my body. But when we explore it, we discover, actually, this idea makes no sense when I really look at it. For the number of reasons that I kind of went through with the body. And we can see that with all that makes up our experience. Yeah, through all the sense doors, even through the way we think. So none of those ways really make sense. And what does that leave us with? Maybe less holding on to it, less demanding of it, less problematic relationship with it. And that's what we're developing. Less and less problematic relationship with everything. From
how action born mm-hmm. from the emptiness.
So the emptiness isn't a thing that gives birth to things in that sense. So actions are born from intentions. Intentions come from wisdom or they come from ignorance. Intentions which come from ignorance into existence leads to actions which lead to dukkha most of the time. Intentions which come from wisdom tend to lead towards actions which lead to ease and well-being and connection and compassion and things like this. Yeah. So we cultivate wisdom for that reason. Yeah. Okay. So I appreciate some of this will be confusing, some of it will be complicated, some of it will be very elementary and a little bit kind of low level for you and kind of how boring that you had to sit through that beginner's class in metta and emptiness. But it was shared hopefully for your benefit and your well-being. And if you now don't feel more well-being and benefit, then maybe it was just a kind of a difficult medicine to swallow tonight. But, yeah, thanks for your listening. And we'll just have a couple of quiet minutes together to close the session. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.